We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Support for this podcast comes from U.S. Bank. U.S. Bank wants to know how you reward yourself, because they have cards that make every day more rewarding. Are you a points hoarder, cashback guru, low intro APR lover? With U.S. Bank, it's up to you, because they have the cards to fit your lifestyle. So earn more whether you're shopping at a gas station or grocery store, even while planning a staycation. Learn more at usbank.com/creditcard. U.S. Bank credit cards are issued by U.S. Bank National Association N.D. Some restrictions may apply. Member FDIC.
Welcome into the RotoWire NFL podcast. It is Thursday, February 11th. I'm your host, John McKechnie, joined as always by Mario Puig. The season is over. We have crowned a new champion, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. If you hadn't paid attention, are the new Super Bowl champions. We're going to get into that just a little bit. We're also going to get into some of the coaching carousel. We're going to kind of finally get a chance to break down the impact on some of these new coaching hires from around the league. Obviously, we're paying a lot of attention to the postseason and all that over the last few weeks. And then we are also going to round things out with a dynasty mock draft. We're going to run through two rounds, taking the top 24 dynasty guys for this year's rookie class. So stay tuned for that, of course, as well. But Mario, what did you think of the Super Bowl?
I don't know what you're talking about. I don't think there was one.
Did you at least like have some good food and like chill?
Again, I don't know what you're talking about with the Super Bowl, but I had good food last weekend. Just as an unrelated thing. I had some good food last weekend, but no football games.
Okay, all right. Well, I see what's going on here. We say no more. Say no more. Let's get on.
No, I mean it was it's just an illegitimate game. I actually turned it off at time. I got to when they threw the flag on Tyrann Mathieu after Tom Brady ran after him to say whatever he did. That he needed to apologize for, and that Tyrann Mathieu won't repeat, which I doubt like Brady said anything like racist or anything, but if you know Tyrann Mathieu's history, you can guess I think what Tom Brady probably said to him.
Oh yeah,
that was so offensive. But anyway, it's good to see the worst people, the most like transparently corrupt, patently evil people get whatever they want for doing nothing in particular. That is the way of the world. It's the design of every power structure of any sort of meaning. Like, this is, these are the results that the system is built for, and the system works perfectly. So it's kind of tedious at this point to get too worked up about it, but it was an illegitimate game. The game was ended by the refs in the first half. And of course you got people pointing out for otherwise valid issues with Kansas City, valid complaints about Kansas City's performance in that game, but you still don't make the game legitimate by pointing those errors out. You know, it's like, it's the fact that that Kansas City's offensive line did poorly, and that you know, whatever, Travis Kelce like dropped that first down pass that kind of made it difficult to come back from. It's like, those things, if they were the reason, if they were the sufficient basis to hand Kansas City a loss, then you don't have the refs doing what they did in that game. Like, it's those refs putting those points on the board, taking that interception away from Matthew, giving a touchdown to the Buccaneers, then giving them another touchdown on the basis of a made up, one or two made up illegal contacts that
the Evans one was pretty egregious. Contact. Yeah.
What's that?
The Evans one down the sideline.
Yeah, and like at most, the commentators were pointing it out. The like Boomer Esiason or whoever pointed it out. It's like, this stuff is nonsense. It's at most, it should have been a couple illegal contacts, but you'll notice that they called defensive pass interferences. And like, I don't doubt that these refs are stupid people in some sense or another, but they're not unfamiliar with the rules. They knew what they were doing. There was an objective that they had in mind. They put it into motion. They know perfectly well what is catchable and what isn't, and they know that uncatchable balls are 5-yard penalties, not spot of the foul penalties, and yet they only went with the spot of the foul approach on those throws. So, I guess with the exception of the interception, but like, the ball wasn't thrown to the person that they were saying was interfered with on that play. So otherwise they I'm sure would have called it if they could have. But it's just crooked, and there's not really much else to say. If the refs didn't put those points on the board too, the Kansas City offensive line doesn't look quite as bad. You know, it's like you have to understand that, like, when you put a team like that, especially when they're shorthanded the way they were, and you put them in that position, you're going to just make all of their mistakes matter more than for the other team. Like, it's not a good response to say, like, well, the game was still legitimate because Kansas City could have played better. It's like, yeah, they could have, and they still would have lost. That's the point. Like, the Tampa Bay could have played worse and still would have won because of what the refs arranged. And that, at that point, is an illegitimate contest. Like, Kansas City could have won anyway, but the game is not a realistic measure of anything. It's just it was arranged as it was. So I don't know. I think it's. It's kind of like one of those things that you could say, well, as a bettor, you should have known that Tampa Bay, having the connections that they do, Tom Brady being the person that he is, you should have known that corruption would be an issue in this setting. And it's like, true. I mean, it's if you bet on a rigged election in these betting sites, it's like, you still get the payout if the rigged side wins. I'm not talking about the U.S. election, but that's true with the sports betting too. It's like, you don't win after like a ref factor adjustment. The winner is the winner, and Tom Brady has these things happen for him over and over and over, and it's probably not a coincidence, and some people probably were correct to make calculations on that fact.
I had it right.
You had it for incidental other correct reasons, I think. If you had thrown in the Tom Brady corruption factor, you would have probably gotten the spread right too. You had the spread right, but you would have more specifically been able to be like, I'm thinking Tampa by like 22 or whatever.
Yeah, Bucks alternate line. Yeah, and just really, really take down a book.
I'd like to get odds on minus 21. I think like that's what you would have come up to, if you had factored in the refs. That's where your reasoning would have took you. I think
you're right. I will say that the officiating in the first half especially was something that completely altered the course of the game. I can't disagree with you there, but I don't know. I did feel like on a play-to-play basis, the Bucks just kind of, I know this is a clean podcast, but the Bucks just kind of kicked the Chiefs' butt the entire game, I thought. Like the,
I don't. I mean, that Ronald Jones goal line stop, the interception by Matthew, if those kinds of things could have mattered if it weren't for the interception being overruled and then Tampa Bay being handed by the refs two touchdowns from that particular point with like a minute and a half left in the half, that just ended the game right there. And if it weren't for that, you know, like Tampa Bay could have still won, certainly. Like I guess you could say they probably would have, but like that's one half of football to come back from that sort of point deficit. Like it practically ended the game. And it's like if Tyrann Mathieu's interception stands and Tampa Bay scores a touchdown on that drive, then in the next kickoff, there's no series of flags to bring Tampa Bay 60 yards in 15 seconds without any timeouts or whatever.
Andy Reid was nice in doing that and helping out on that front.
That's true, but it's still the case that like if we're not talking about this illegal contact that they threw on Charvarius Ward against Mike Evans and the interference against Mike Evans and Bashaud Breeland and then the taunting penalty on Tyrann Mathieu, that game is maybe 3 points going into halftime, and instead it was what, like 16 or whatever?
Yeah,
like
So that is.
Like we see games come down to the last drive, the last play all the time. And those are drives, multiple drives worth of points. That's a quarter at least of dominant play points wise that the refs just gave the Buccaneers, you know. Mm-hmm. It just made everything else meaningless. It's just nothing signal wise there. It's just a manufactured outcome for me.
I guess I don't know. The thinking, I guess we finally found the breaking point for the Chiefs in the sense that you know, that there was a deficit that they could not overcome.
Yeah, in that situation, it's not possible, really.
No, Tampa Bay's defense was too good.
Well, the refs also seemed to understand that you had to make it a two-score question, right? It's like the whole thing about Mahomes never losing when it's a one-score game. The refs made sure that wasn't the particular question. Right. They made it two scores, more than two. So it of course could be just a series of coincidences, but
that's seven. You know, seven times in the Super Bowl have those wild coincidences happen now.
Yeah, at the very least, like Tom Brady talks to these refs and like lobbies at them and distorts their understanding of what their job is, because that's the charitable read. The less charitable read is that they're criminals, and I don't know which is more likely. It could be both too. I don't want to rule that out, but it was a crap game. It was a corrupt, a rotten product that is emblematic and appropriate for just kind of like the scam casino society that we live in, this mafia organized crime society. It's like these are the sorts of things that you get. You get rigged elections, you get rigged just industry, rigged outcomes left and right. And this really looks just kind of like machine football or something. I don't know. It's pretty difficult. It's pretty difficult to believe that people could be that bad at their jobs. You know, it's at some point you're the charitable one for assuming they're crooked.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was. Yeah, that won't go down as one of my favorite Super Bowls. I will say that. I don't have too much more to add on top to the stuff that you were saying. Let's go ahead. Let's talk about some coaches. You just posted a new article up on the site that'll be a nice kind of one-stop shop for anyone that's trying to look into the deeper meanings of these coaching hires from across the league, the kind of scheme and philosophies that these guys are bringing into their new teams. But you have all 32 teams covered, to be clear. I want to start things out in Detroit. I mean, they've been kind of one of the more highly visible teams this offseason, as far as, you know, the big Jared Goff trade, of course, and then of course the new hires as well, bringing in Dan Campbell, bringing Anthony Lynn as the offensive coordinator, Aaron Glenn as the defensive coordinator. I mean, I thought that all of that was a little bit surprising. I didn't really think that Dan Campbell was like a hot name on the coaching search, I don't know, newswire, whatever, but here he is. So Detroit, given what they have as far as draft capital and this new staff, how do you grade things for them as it stands right now?
Well, I'm pretty low on Jared Goff, so I'm not optimistic about that reclamation project. But in terms of just the coaching hires, I think Detroit's basically looking fine. Like, it's not a case where I look and I get high expectations exactly, but I do think a lot of the sort of football Twitter media sphere freak out about Dan Campbell. And I don't mean like the people who were kind of hamming it up with his, you know, he was saying all that ridiculous stuff about how our strategy is to
bite you in the knee and stuff.
Bite you in the knee, let you punch me in the face, and then I get back up and I bite your other knee or whatever, and so on and so on. And that's, you know, like, that's crazy person talk, but these people are insane. They're football players, you know, like the guys like Dan Campbell are not like your neighbors. Like they you don't get to have the sort of character disposition to be a run blocking tight end in the NFL, you know, just basically being a professional head against the wall basher. It takes a certain type of person to want to do that job and do that job effectively. So Dan Campbell speaks the way I think you could reasonably expect someone of his background to speak, but it doesn't really mean anything. Like, he just kind of talks that way. A lot of coaches talk that way. A lot of coaches do a lot of insane stuff that people don't hear about. And Campbell's just a little more candid, I think, a little less concerned with portraying a certain image of himself, or at least like he doesn't care about portraying himself, you know, differently than what he is. Like, I guess he kind of soaked up the spotlight there and hammed it up, but it's not because he was distorting anything. He was just kind of showing you what an earnest version of his behavior is like. So he's a guy who, yes, he was a run blocking tight end in the NFL, and with the Saints the last 4 years, he's been a tight ends coach, and he talked about how he wants to run the ball. And I saw people before that press conference freaking out because he said, I basically have the philosophy of Bill Parcells does. And that was the Bill Parcells thing was especially stupid. And people really showed their historical ignorance on that one, because as much as Bill Parcells was, you know, a fogey, hard ass something or other, as a football mind, he was not that much of like an ideologue or anything. Like, he was pretty pragmatic, actually. You could see in certain areas, yeah, he was, you know, run heavy with Curtis Martin, and he really liked to give Martin the ball a lot. But particularly in his early Patriots days, or at least, sorry, not the early Patriots, but the early 90s with the Patriots, the mid-90s with the Patriots, Drew Bledsoe led the league in pass attempts, I think, something like 3 years in a row, mm-hmm. or two out of 3 years. And even in the off year, he was still like third or fourth in pass attempts. So he was putting up pass attempt volume that would have led the league even today in at least one of those seasons. So the idea that like Campbell citing Bill Parcells as his main influence, meaning that Detroit's going to run the ball all the time, like, that's just made up.
Yeah, they don't know who Bill Parcells is then, or I don't know.
Yeah, it's like it might end up being the case that Dan Campbell runs the ball a lot, but it's not because of anything to do with that Bill Parcells comment. Like, it would be within the Bill Parcells range of outcomes to lead the league in pass attempts, because he's done it already. It's just, there's nothing to really read there. But yeah, if you give Parcells age 37 Vinny Testaverde or Ray Lucas or Jay Fiedler at quarterback, man. Yeah, he'll probably try to run the ball a lot, even if it's Adrian Morrell, who he has at running back. But like, that's just, you know, that's the making the most of the situation, which is to say pragmatism. And
I just heard all of those names in NFL Blitz voice.
Oh yeah, I know so many stupid 90s late 80s names. Like, it would it's already driven me mad, and I think if I, you know, laid it out, it would have sort of an insanity rune effect.
I'm thinking of like Wesley Walls right now.
Oh, Wesley Walls, that's mainstream, dude.
No, I'm sorry.
You gotta go to the real underground material. Like, I'm
Ray Lucas was pretty strong.
Bring me your Jay Reimers Muzz or something. but anyway,
where's your Stony Case at?
Okay, I don't know who that is.
There we
is.
Go. I had to like hit like the DEFCON 1 button for
was that a
like
quarterback.
He like made like one start for the Ravens one time in the late 90s.
Oh, that's cool. the Michael Jackson Ravens.
Yeah. Yes.
Nice.
That's a good one. That was a good time. But anyway, you know, it's just so many of these people in the emerging analytics sphere of football media are just instantly triggered by the vaguest acknowledgement or vaguest expression of fondness for running the ball in any scenario. Just absolute fire.
They lose it. They lose their minds.
It's unbelievable, man. And I mean, it's kind of consistent with their general lack of critical thinking ability and their general indifference toward historical fact. Like they just don't really care about the details. And so it's like, yeah, why not just freak out like some sort of animal, I don't know what to describe this particular type of person, but it's happening all the time. And I hate to watch it. These people who think that like they're smart and virtuous for ignoring evidence that might contradict the sort of dogma that they go in presupposing.
Wasn't there like a deduction that caught some traction earlier this week from the Super Bowl that like saying that Mahomes actually had more time to throw than Brady, and it's like, didn't think about why.
Well, Ben Baldwin was tweeted something like, you know, Pat Mahomes had 3.1 seconds from snap to throw, and that no matter how good your offensive line is, you can't really do better than that, or something like that. It's like, sometimes with Ben, you got to do a little unpacking on the psychology and the ideology of everything that he's going through. That one was pretty simple. I was like, oh, man, you didn't watch it. You don't know what happened.
Yep.
You're just making this up. You're guessing. So that one was pretty simple. It's like Ben just made some stuff up, and he, I'm sure, felt silly once he saw a little bit more of the thing that he was talking about, even though he didn't research it or understand it at all. But yeah, that was pretty funny. But in any case, like all those were the types of people who were freaking out about Dan Campbell, and it was like borderline dishonest the way that they addressed that, because you have to be a moron, I think, to not understand Campbell as saying that he's just kind of open to whatever, because he in the same press conference that he talked about how he like wants to run the ball, and he was saying like, we're going to do musket warfare against the other team, lining up against each other in orderly fashion, chopping ourselves and them down until eventually we win. Like, he was saying that. And then at the same like paragraph, he basically goes, oh, and DeAndre Swift, we're going to use him exactly like Alvin Kamara. So I don't understand what people reconciled that with the idea that Dan Campbell's just going to run the ball, I formation, three tight ends every play. It's like, he's pretty specifically referring to the Saints offense, the Drew Brees, Sean Payton offense, which threw for 5,000 yards like five times in 10 years. And that's, you know, if you're going to get like, no one was getting mad about Dan Campbell for saying he was going to run the Sean Payton offense. Like, that wasn't the narrative. The narrative was like, Dan Campbell's a bad guy. He's going to run. What did they think? Like the wishbone? I don't know what they thought he was going to do. But then he specifically names Alvin Kamara and the Saints offense, and there's just like, yeah, we're not going to talk about that. We're gonna pretend we're mad instead about this, the heresy that he committed by saying that it's okay to run the ball sometimes. Like, it's just, there's just this triggered, like it's just like a rigged freak out machine where it's just like someone pulls the lever, which is saying, which is like acknowledging that running the ball is a viable thing to do, and that like you don't necessarily need to throw the ball all the time. Like, any sentiment toward that effect just like brings out the immediate response squad, the rapid response squad of people just screaming on the internet and throwing a fit about how this guy is trying to turn football back. Like, you know, he'll always punt on fourth down. Like
God forbid. That,
this is just utter trash. Like, it's just, at this point, it's just propaganda. You know, it's like, you prefer throwing the ball, you aesthetically or for whatever ideological reason don't like running the ball, just state your preference. Stop trying to browbeat everyone else into agreeing with you, and stop arguing that anyone who disagrees with you isn't dumbass. It's like, there's no basis for that. You're the dumb one. You're the one who keeps being wrong about all the quarterbacks. Like, you guys are the ones who would have fell for Timmy Chang and Jason White, because all you really know how to do is like just valorize pass attempt volume, really. It's all very stupid. But okay, to try to bring it back a little bit, Dan Campbell, I think, is basically there to try to run something like the Saints offense, where he's been the tight ends coach and assistant head coach for the past 4 years. And then he named Alvin Kamara. So I think you can just expect Campbell to try to carry that meathead, you know, trench warfare ethos and attitude. But in practice, he's just going to try to get the ball to his best players, you know, which I don't know why that isn't a sufficient football ideology.
Yeah, that seems
just
pretty
get the
fine.
Ball in your best players. That's the smart thing to do. So if he does that, I have no complaints, even if he sometimes runs the ball on first and 10, or if he says in a press conference, I'd like to run better, you know, I'm not going to freak out about it. But there's a sort of disciplining, there's like a sort of, I don't know what you'd call it. Like there's this collection of interests in football media who want to discipline and like browbeat anybody who proposes narratives contrary to theirs. And that's at this point what the Dan Campbell freak out is. It's conditioning people to behave a certain way, because I refuse to believe that people are so dumb as to not understand the guy for what he's saying, which was literally, we're going to make DeAndre Swift Alvin Kamara. So that's not the wishbone, you know? The Saints offense is not the wishbone. We don't need to pretend otherwise. And Aaron Glenn's kind of interesting. And I think Aaron Glenn, that signing or that hiring is proof that it really is going to be a little bit more Bill Parcells than Sean Payton specifically. And Sean Payton was brought up under Parcells too. But the difference is, I don't think they're going to run like that Dennis Allen defense. The Dennis Allen defense was really good for the Saints, but Aaron Glenn is like Parcells' guy. He went with Bill Parcells all over the place, Texans aside. Like he was with Parcells with the Jets and then Dallas after that. And he was such a good corner. But yeah, I think you might see them go to more of like a 3-4 or basically like the modern, the current Belichickian defenses. Like the Belichick defense is the amoeba stuff that you see in the league. That's the logical progression of the Bill Parcells defensive principles from like the 90s and the 2000s. So I wouldn't be surprised if you see them go away from that 4-3 kind of base and go do stuff that's like 3-3-5, 2-5, whatever, stuff like that.
Okay, interesting. All right, so sounds like despite some of the like you said, the outcry initially, Detroit might have actually done pretty well for itself as far as this hiring is concerned. It can't be much worse than what it was under Patricia.
Oh,
I'll
God,
say
no.
That much. I think the next one up that we'll get into, Houston. This was maybe the most surprising of the hires. I mean, like, I don't think most people had even heard of David Culley outside of, you know, football circles, and it sounds like he has the utmost respect of like pretty much everywhere he's worked. Everyone really likes him and everything. But then everyone also, you know, smashed, you know, if he's the receiving coach for the Ravens and the Ravens have like, what, the 31st, 32nd, you know, ranked receiving yardage numbers from its wide receivers, you know, that this is a hire that I think universally got panned right out of the gate. But what say you?
I don't know, man. I mean, I think there's a lot of political subtext to this one, and frankly, I don't know what the responsible speculation would be. Like, I think given Jack Easterby's background and knowing what just a scoundrel and what a treacherous person he is, and the level of cynicism that he's capable of, I wouldn't be surprised if he largely hired Culley just to try to get Deshaun Watson back by being like, look, I hired an African-American coach. You want to come back now, right? And of course that didn't work. But beyond that, apparently Culley is a part of like the very overtly Christian club that like Easterby is at, the Association of Christian Athletes or something like that, that Easterby is a figure within, and Culley's a figure within, and Josh McCown, who they interviewed for their offensive or who they brought in as offensive coordinator, like they, or sorry, not offensive coordinator, quarterbacks coach or something. They're still keeping Tim Kelly at offensive coordinator, who was a guy that Deshaun actually asked for. But Culley, beyond like his wide receiver coaching, like, I guess to be fair, he's been around a lot of good teams, but it's just, he never gets into a position of meaningful authority with any of them. It's like he just keeps bouncing around. And I don't know what to assume about him specifically. Like, it's, he seems like at the very least a good practice coach, like the kind of guy who kind of keeps the culture, you know, moving in the right direction, keeps practice moving, keeps guys productive, while the head coach deals with schematics and whatever else. But I don't, even if you don't really blame him for the Baltimore receivers, which I don't, I blame that more on like the GM and Greg Roman, putting the worst players on the field. Like, I don't know what you can coach up with the way they were calling those plays. It's like they more or less went the way they were supposed to. It's just by definition, they were bad ideas. So I don't really blame him for those receivers or anything, but it just seems like a cynical hire that it doesn't seem to have much substance behind it. Like at best, it was like Easterby was kind of like, he might be good. He seems like a good guy. And, you know, maybe that's enough. Maybe Cully will surprise everyone and maybe he'll prove that he should have gotten a job sooner. But it's going to be pretty hard to do that for the worst team in the league, you know, like the most mismanaged team busted, in the league. Yeah. Like he's going to have to do it without Watson. And even if they get a good haul for Watson, what reason is there to believe they won't blow those picks? Like there's nothing there. We don't know what's going to go on with Will Fuller. We don't know if they'll be able to keep Brandon Cooks. We don't know what their cap fallout's going to look like exactly. It's just brutal. No one who has a future in the league is accepting that job, you know? So it's like Cully, it's like maybe this is the best chance that he's going to get, but it's still a doomed chance.
That's a great way of framing it. Like that Houston right now is like radioactive. It's not good. It's like it almost is analogous to Philadelphia in the sense that like whoever comes in next is probably just going to be the sacrificial lamb for the next 2-3 years until like they're ready to fire the coach and start the rebuild in full earnest with enough draft capital to really make it happen.
I don't remember a case like this ever before. I think it's going to be a sort of a landmark case study in team sabotage though.
Yeah, it's not great. So Houston fans, sorry in advance. Let's hit one more. I'd love to hear your thoughts on Urban Meyer in Jacksonville. I have some thoughts as well, but I'd like to hear yours.
Yeah, man. I don't know. I'm mostly getting bad vibes from this cuz Urban Meyer is just
some of the hires
guy.
Have been head scratch. Like yeah, the kind of ones that like if you were suspicious as to how Urban would translate to the NFL, this confirms your priors.
Yeah, I guess I'll say the Daryl Bevel Brian Schottenheimer thing is actually the least of my concerns. I know that like I don't like either of them. I'm not like defending them exactly, but I think we've seen enough of Urban Meyer in the college level to know that he's not an I formation guy. He's if anything, he's going to be like a run heavy kind of coach, like the basic fear that people derive from Bevel and especially Schottenheimer. Like if they're going to be a run heavy team, then they're going to be a Chip Kelly run heavy team. Like it's going to be an up tempo spread kind of thing. It's not going to be I formation. 1990s Wisconsin offense like Daryl Bevel really traces back to, and it's not going to be like Brian Schottenheimer with the Seahawks because just the Trevor Lawrence selection alone compels them to open up the offense. Like even the most run obsessive coach like Pete Carroll, if he had Trevor Lawrence, would open up that offense more because he can just, I know Russell Wilson's great. I'm not saying Lawrence will specifically be as good as Wilson because he probably won't, but in theory he can do everything. There's no trait that he lacks. It's like you're not going to run an I formation with him because even the most run obsessive coach is going to be in practice with Lawrence and be like, whoa, that was a cool throw that he did. Let's see more of that. So Daryl Bevel will not call like a wishbone offense with Lawrence. They're going to open it up. Maybe they run the ball a lot, but they're going to spread it out a bit for sure. I just don't think if Meyer was going to make an offense like Bevel and Schottenheimer do, then he could have done it at Utah or Florida or Ohio State. And he went spread in all of those cases, you know? So I'm not really worried about that, but I am worried about Urban Meyer. I think he's a scoundrel. I don't think there's really much debate to be had about it. Like he's a bad guy. And not just that, but he's kind of a treacherous person. Like he's the kind of person who knows that he's bad and strategizes accordingly and just doesn't really feel bad about being underhanded. And for those reasons, that makes me think about Bobby Petrino quite a bit. Like, and you don't even need to specifically, you know, make the leap. Like, you don't need to project Urban Meyer's NFL character and come up with, like, you know, maybe he could be the next Bobby Petrino. It's like, he's kind of already been that at the college level. It's like, he'll pretend that he has a heart condition when he doesn't feel like going to work. So if he gets to this job and things get a little difficult, or if some college school, you know, gives their current crap coach an $80 million buyout and then offers Meyer a really big contract, I could see him just cutting bait after this year, 2 years or something. Especially if he gets the team into some sort of trouble, you know. But in terms of what Meyer actually is as a coach, it's hard for me to really figure that out, because it's like, the results were pretty much automatic in college, but that also was largely the result of his recruiting.
Yes, exactly. Which, it's so different.
There's no analogous task in the NFL to recruiting in college football. So Meyer just loses pretty much all of his theoretical advantage with that alone. Yep. So it's possible that he is, in addition to that, a really good, you know, like practice coach and schemer and in-game judgment kind of coach. That's possible, but it's not basis of his college results. Like, you can be a pretty stupid coach with talent like he has and still had, especially at like Ohio State.
Yes.
And, well, I guess Florida too.
Florida,
it was pretty. Yeah, that Florida offense was pretty ridiculous at its peak. So he might be good. It's just there's no actual evidence of it, or at least there's no evidence that he's good at NFL coaching. It's totally different. But I hate that strength and conditioning coach hire. Like, I think they're actually going to have to reverse that, because that guy's just a racist villain. And
he's the Iowa guy that got fired over the summer, right?
Yeah. It's like, there was a lot bad about those Iowa reports, including the Ferentz family. But that one guy that I don't even remember his name, like, he still stood out as like like a level worse. And then Urban Meyer apparently was just like, that's my guy.
Yeah, Chris Doyle.
Yeah, so we'll see. I think Urban, the other thing that Urban's going to get all mad about and he's not going to like is the fact that his like almost mob way of exerting power in college, like, that's not going to happen in the NFL. Like, these guys get paid. You don't get to threaten to take away their tuition, or you know, you're not going to be able to wield their poverty anxiety as unpaid inner city kids or whatever. Like, he's not going to have this leverage to twist their arms and make them submit to him the way that he did in college. And other coaches have struggled with that in the NFL too. You know,
big it's time. Like, it sounds Nick Saban.
Yeah, like Saban, it seems like Chip Kelly didn't really adjust well to getting lip back from his players. So if you are the kind of guy like Urban Meyer is, you're going to alienate people and you're going to alienate players. And he is of the mindset that, like, they are subjects of his, which they don't agree with. And he's just objectively wrong about. Like, they're getting paid. And especially if it's like a good player, it's like, you're just going to have to, like, I guess, in, you know, that's how Chip Kelly ended up just saying, like, oh, I guess we'll just trade DeSean Jackson then. You know, it's like, that's the kind of stuff that I'm worried about with Meyer, like, alienating players and running out the good ones, replacing them with passive ones, making the team worse over some stretch of time. I don't know. But yeah, I think they're going to have to just reverse on this strength and conditioning hire, because
that's not going to go over well.
If the players don't raise hell about that, I'm going to be pretty surprised.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think you pretty much nailed the important points on Meyer and have it pretty much covered. And, you know, just kind of backing up what you said, you know, I think big time college football coaches, their path to the top is so different than the path to the top in the NFL. And it's almost like just two completely different things entirely. So
he's used to being just like all those coaches are used to being tyrants and never being questioned. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you got to learn how to work with, you know, this, it's like a different kind of system and you need to work with it and cooperate and build like a culture of something vaguely productive. And you can't just build it on threats.
Nope. And, you know, and as far as roster building is concerned, you know, the best don't like continue to separate themselves from the pack as far as their opportunities are concerned. Like the NFL is, you know, inherently something that introduces, you know, some parity. And obviously Jacksonville gets to benefit from that by getting Trevor Lawrence this year while being the worst team in the league last year. Like that's the way the NFL is set up. But like, yeah, Urban Meyer is not going to be able to bring in these recruiting classes that only two to three other teams can touch. And then by, you know, the third year of that, you know, they are one of the three best teams in the NFL. It's just not how it works at this level. So I just don't understand that. And I think from like a makeup standpoint, he's not someone that has ever been used to losing and has visually been a very sore loser in the past. I love the Papa John's picture more than maybe anything.
Dude, has he lost? He's been like, he's triggered himself over what, like five losses in 10 years or something?
Yes. I mean, you and I, this was, you know, this is way pre-pandemic. I think this was like the 2018 season. Ohio State goes to Maryland, and Maryland's beating Ohio State in the fourth quarter, and Urban Meyer starts squatting down on the sideline with his head in his hands, like he's having some sort of medical episode because he's losing. Like that's not gonna do well when you're taking on a Jacksonville team that might win three games and lose 13.
Yeah, he will lose more games in one season as an NFL coach than he probably has.
We'll see what his stomach is for this.
Yeah, so I mean, Petrino, people acted like it was outrageous his exit, but like we knew he was kind of a scoundrel. If someone is a scoundrel, you have to be prepared for them behaving like a weasel. And this is central casting. Urban Meyer is like the prototypical lead man for that particular character. And I think the unfortunate reality is that Shad Khan, the owner for the Jaguars, was largely drawn toward Urban Meyer and identified with him so much just because he's a bad guy. Like, I think that impresses people like Khan, people in positions of abusive power like that. They see abusive people like Meyer and they think like, that's awesome how evil that guy is. He's so good at being a tyrant. And I think they have like reflexive admiration for that. So I think that's part of what the allure was for Khan. And I think it's going to be, you know, basically the story of why it won't work.
Yep. So not particularly looking forward to the Urban era. But I do still hope that above all else, it's not something that still ends up like impacting what Trevor Lawrence can be in the NFL.
He'll
like,
be fine. It's just going to be he'll be fine. It's just I really think you might just see Meyer just quit after this year. Like if they go 8-8, I can see him just being like,
that wasn't worth it.
I'm going home.
Yeah. Forget this. Okay. Let's shift on over to the second portion of the podcast. Let's do our dynasty mock draft for this rookie class. So essentially Mario and I are going to go back and forth alternating picks 1 to 24, just as it would be in a, in your dynasty rookie draft. That's pretty much the extent of it. Mario, would you like to go first or second?
I'll go second, John.
Okay. All right, leading things off, I am going to start things out with... Ooh, it's tough. Give me Ja'Marr Chase, receiver out of LSU.
I think that's the right pick, yeah.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, the tape is so dominant. I think that I won't be surprised if in a month or two from now, people have talked themselves into like just by being bozos or whatever, that they'll come up with so many different ways to say that Ja'Marr Chase shouldn't be the number one guy. And like they will delete those posts by week two. Like I don't really see there being any legitimate cases being made against him. He is crazy. I don't know what more you need to know. I mean, the production's insane. The age adjusted production insane. Athleticism looks to be pretty much off the charts. Got the right frame for a wide receiver NFL wide receiver one in the NFL. I just don't think there's really anything more to add to that. This is kind of a no brainer to me.
Yeah, I love Chase too. It's pretty rare that you see a guy as densely built as him at his age 19 season. So he was listed at 6'2", 208. It wouldn't be that surprising to me if he's like 6 foot, 215 or something. And if he runs better than like a 4.45, it's just blue chip grade all across the board. He's the real deal. And I don't know if it'll be like, I don't think there's any risk of the NFL getting bored with him. I think it'll be a contrarian position in like NFL draft media if there are people who are questioning him. But you're going to see some people put Smith ahead and Devontae Smith ahead. And I think it's pretty easy to say why that's wrong. It's just Ja'Marr Chase did Devontae Smith stuff at 3 years younger, and he's 30 pounds heavier on the same height. So that's why Chase
and
is
he also had Justin Jefferson and Terrace Marshall. I mean, like, not that Devontae Smith didn't have it, but he was the only show in town basically after
Justin
Waddle
Jefferson
got hurt.
We already saw what Justin Jefferson is, and Chase was basically better at 6 months younger in the same off. That doesn't mean he's guaranteed to be as good and or is better or sorry or better than Justin Jefferson, but it's pretty close. As much as I would have liked to have taken Chase with the second pick, I'm going to be totally content to take Travis Etienne here. And I've mentioned this before, going into last year's combine season, or I guess going into January 15th of last year, I was prepared to rank Travis Etienne ahead of Jonathan Taylor, who after Etienne dropped out, you know, Taylor was my number one guy, and it just wasn't a serious question at any point. Etienne probably will not grade as high for me as a prospect as Taylor ended up, because Taylor ran a 4.39 40 at 230 pounds or whatever, which was pretty close, or it was assumed like that was just pretty close to best case scenario. So I didn't assume that would happen. I was trying to imagine the mid-range outcomes for Etienne and Taylor, but Taylor had his best range outcome, and Etienne could too. I mean, I guess I'm not going to be exactly surprised if he measures in at like 5'11", 208, and then runs a 4.35 or something. That wouldn't be shocking, but it's still unfair to expect that specifically. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't need to do that well to still be easily the best running back in this class to me. And aside from Taylor, one of the best in a, I don't know, going back like 5 years, something like that.
Yeah.
He's the most explosive running back in college football history. And I saw some people freak out about that when I kind of hinted at that. But it's like talking about Barry Sanders is 1 year, talking about, I don't know, whoever else.
Reggie Bush.
I'm not saying that there weren't other great running backs, but you can't really find anyone else who has 60 rushing touchdowns and 7.2 yards per carry over 4 years. Like, that's just not a thing that's been done. So I'm inclined to assume that Etienne really does have a certain something that very few running backs do. And particularly given what he showed as a pass catcher this year, I don't think that it's reasonable to fret about his frame or you know, say something like he needs to run a 4.4. If Etienne runs better than like a 4.48 or something, I think I'm enthusiastically buying, and I kind of expect him to do safely better than that.
Yeah. Yeah. That, like you said, like that's sort of like the cutoff point. And I think there's plenty of room between that and where we can realistically expect him to, you know, I think he's probably going to run in the low 4.4s. At worst, basically, with a chance of getting into the 4.3s. I mean, again, like you said, the explosiveness was so off the charts. I mean, those first 3 years, averaging 7.8 yards per carry over 500 carries, like that's just insane. And then
and the touchdown count too.
It's right.
Like, people aren't considering how many of these plays were just no contest, broke the defense kind of plays, because it's like the end zone had to make so many of the tackles on him.
Mm-hmm. It absolutely did. So, I mean, yeah, those could have been longer. The average could have been even crazier. And it's not even like he was running behind these, like, insane offensive lines. Like, the, I don't know. Can you name any Clemson Simpson offensive linemen that get drafted?
It was like that Simpson guard was a third rounder, right? And that's basically it.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, again, it's not like he was running behind, you know, the Oklahoma or the Alabama offensive line. Like, he's doing a lot of the work, and obviously defenses have to respect Trevor Lawrence. That
he did it before Lawrence, didn't he?
2017, yeah.
So it's, I don't know. I mean, he could still fail, but
yeah,
I don't know what he could have possibly done more to convince anyone going in.
Exactly. So, yeah, hashtag doubted. So, Travis Etienne goes off the board at two. I will take his teammate, Trevor Lawrence, at three. I don't think that in the years that we've been doing these type of exercises that we've had a quarterback go like in a dynasty top five, but
Kyler maybe. I know I had Kyler ranked really high after the draft, but that was only when it was clear that he was going to be in, you know, the quote unquote air raid.
Right.
But yeah, it's pretty rare. Like, Lawrence is pretty easily the best quarterback prospect ever, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's insane. Again, not a ton that really needs to be said that hasn't already been said. Just, you know, this is a dude that I've known about since he was like a freshman or sophomore in high school. And like I follow recruiting. Everyone knows that. But like I don't follow it that closely. But like even like the casual recruiting people knew who he was long before he got to Clemson. And I mean, the guy just was as advertised the second he stepped onto the field. I mean, just unbelievable. Yeah. You know, forced out a guy in Kelly Bryant who led Clemson to the playoff the year before, just made him transfer, basically goes ahead, leads Clemson to the national title game, blows out Alabama as a true freshman with insane numbers. And, you know, I thought he was just as good or better and like continued to improve his following 2 years. He just ran into a couple of juggernauts that had an edge one way or the other. Like, I don't think anyone was beating LSU. I don't know if any team could ever have beaten the 2019 LSU team. And then Bama this year, not too far behind. So, or I guess that they ran into Ohio State in the playoff, but I don't pin that loss on Lawrence. I pin that more on the offensive line, blah, blah, blah. That has nothing to do with his actual prospect evaluation. Yeah, I mean, he's got the arm. He's got
like he could run for a lot in the NFL
yes.
too. Like, people don't really. I think a lot of people don't realize what an athlete he is.
He outran the Ohio State defense for a 60-yard touchdown in the playoff a couple years ago. Like that, just look at that. That's not normal.
As an NFL quarterback prospect, Trevor Lawrence is basically a Megatron or LeBron James kind of figure, and I see people – like, I understand that Justin Fields is a really interesting quarterback prospect too, but people got to understand there is not a question about this. Lawrence is the best quarterback in this draft, and he's the best quarterback prospect ever. And that's not to say he's going to be the best quarterback ever, because there's fluctuations from a prospect's baseline, you know, just circumstantial reasons, random chance, whatever. Those things affect where the player's career trajectory actually goes in practice. But in terms of the variables that we can know ahead of time, no one has ever graded this well. And the next closest player you're talking about is someone like Peyton Manning, who maybe Peyton Manning was safely better than Lawrence as a passer. I'm not really willing to concede that, but even if it's true, there's never been a quarterback who's both close to Lawrence as a passer and half as good of a runner as he is.
Right.
Like he could be, if he were a bad passer, Lawrence could be like an 800-yard rusher in the NFL, but he won't need to run quite that much because he is an elite passing prospect too.
Yep. So, I mean, like he's a guy that, again, easy top five, like rookie dynasty selection, someone that I think by our projections is like draftable as a QB1.
I think so.
Yeah. So,
because it's,
getting some shares.
If he throws 32 pass attempts a game, I think that's all you really need to know, because he'll probably run, I don't know, like 5-6 times. He's probably going to average 6 or 7 yards a carry. He's probably going to get a touchdown on bootlegs here and there. So he really has a ton of fantasy upside, and I think people underestimate how much he might run in the NFL, even though he doesn't even really need that sort of he doesn't need that lane to come through at the price people want to pay or people have to pay. But with the fourth pick, John, I'm going to go with Jalen Waddle. He's just kind of one of my guys. I remember when the first time I saw him at Alabama, I just kind of did that thing where I'm like, oh, that guy's insane. I think he's going to be insanely good. And Devontae Smith turned out to have the more illustrious career ending. And I don't really mean to argue against Smith over Waddle, but I prefer Waddle because he's listed at a couple inches shorter than Devontae Smith and a few pounds heavier, which I know it's people look at things like 6'1", 175, 5'11", 183. That's barely any difference. It's actually a pretty big difference. And if Waddle's faster than Smith, which I think he is, then their density adjusted speed is far apart from each other. So granted, Waddle never took on the volume that Smith did at Alabama, but I'm willing to roll the dice in this case and think that the NFL projection will make Waddle a better pro player than he was a college player. And he was already just an insanely good college player.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I saw some stuff. Careful, like, what you look at on Twitter. And that, I mean, that goes for anything, but like,
don't go on Twitter.
Yeah. Just listen to us, please. Because, you know, someone was arguing that like Jalen Waddle is like lesser of a prospect because he didn't have some sort of arbitrary breakout. And it's like, well, I mean, he was insanely productive on a per target, per catch, however you want to frame it basis. And like, just because he didn't hit the threshold that you wanted because he shattered his ankle in like week five or whatever against Tennessee, that he didn't hit the, you know, the overall market share threshold that you think is the key to draft prospect analysis. It's just so disingenuous. It's so dumb. I hate it.
People actually believe that stuff, and if they thought through their own logic, they would be embarrassed, you know, because if you follow the actual logical reasoning of that value system, the idea that like if a receiver doesn't get a 35% yardage share on a team, then they're bad. Then what you're saying is every team that has a good receiver, by definition, has to have only bad ones otherwise. And so because the definition of good is the 35 and there's not 150 to go around, you know, if there is a 35, the other guys cannot be good. So in the case of a place like Alabama or LSU, you can only pick one receiver as being good from that group, if any. And if none of them hit that 35, you have to say they're all bad because of this share obsession. It's like just come on, be reasonable, have some common sense. Put a higher expectation of share percentage on a receiver, the lower their surrounding receiver talent is. You know, if you're playing for Alabama, it's okay if you don't get a 30% share, because that's insane to expect when the other four guys are first round picks too, you know?
Yep. And, you know, he had over 20% of the targets in every game in which he played this year, again, other than the Tennessee one where he got injured on the opening kickoff. So, I mean, he was carrying a significant volume before the injury, and he was destroying it with the volume that he was getting. So
he looks a lot like T.Y. Hilton, and that's I think everything lines up so convincingly that I don't even care that he, you know, T.Y. Hilton. People might look at T.Y. Hilton and be like, oh, that's not really shooting for the moon, you know? He's only like 5'9", 180. Like, I don't care. He's an elite receiver. Waddle has all the same traits that made Hilton elite. It's going to work.
Yep. And if you want to have some fun, throw on the 2019 Iron Bowl against Auburn. So Alabama lost that game, but it's so clear that Waddle's the best player on that field that had a ton of first-round players on it. Like, just crazy, crazy stuff. So yeah, love that Waddle pick. I'll just kind of you know, in NASCAR, you get behind someone for the draft or whatever, and I will do that. I will just go ahead and tail you and go Devontae Smith. I think that it's clear what the top three receivers in this class look like, and two of them are off the board already, and I'm not ready to jump up for the next running back and Najee Harris, that type of thing, and I don't think any quarterback is quite worthy of a top five in this, other than Trevor Lawrence, of course. So I'll just go with Devontae Smith, just kind of make it easy on myself. I don't think there's you know, I understand the concerns about the frame and everything, but man, the guy is just good at football. Like, just don't worry so much about it.
Yeah, it's one thing for people to point out that there are sort of concerning trends with respect to Smith's age and Smith's frame. Like, you can point towards certain players that had age and frame similarities. And in the article that I wrote about Devontae Smith, that it was specifically talking about Paul Richardson and Dede Westbrook. But that's a small sample kind of thing too. First of all, he's not actually similar to them in terms of production. Like, you can distinguish that Devontae Smith from those two on the basis of production. But even if you couldn't, two instances is not a real sample of any kind. Like, you can't make scientific conclusions from that unless you're just scientifically reckless. So even if there were, you know, some sort of signal to that, those two instances is not in itself real proof of it. Like, if anything, you should probably think, like, the third instance of this sample who comes along is probably just on the basis of chance going to turn out different. But I don't think it's on the basis of chance. I think it's on the basis of skill. You can see that Devontae Smith is distinguished from Paul Richardson and Dede Westbrook. And don't get me wrong, I wish there were a good case outcome that I could easily point at. But the reason there isn't one is just because we're talking about like a small category in the first place, you know? And I think if you really need a current league example of how Devontae Smith can make it work, I think it would actually be Robbie Anderson, who's a little different, but he has the same concern with Smith in terms of the skinny frame. And Robbie's even a little bit skinnier yet, maybe. Like, at worst, he's exactly the same as Smith is exactly the same as Anderson. But Anderson is 6'3", like a real 6'3", not a 6'1 and 2/8 kind of thing. Mm-hmm. He is 6'3", and he is no heavier than 185 pounds. Whereas Devontae's probably going to be like a mid 6'1, high 6'1, and like 180. Or something like that. So the reason Robbie Anderson can make it work in his case is because he has a lot of skill, probably not as much as Devontae, but he also has the 4.35 speed. With Devontae, I don't think it's going to be like speed that he needs. It's just going to be like the fact that he plays receiver better makes up for it. But yeah, I took Waddle obviously over Smith, but I would never argue someone taking Smith over Waddle. If you can get the fifth spot instead of the fourth in a draft order, it's almost preferable because you can just kind of like spare yourself the anxiety of having to choose. Just take either of them, and they're both about as good as you could realistically hope for.
Yep. Step three, profit.
Yep. So I'll hope to profit as well with my sixth overall pick here. I'm going to go with Terrace Marshall from LSU. It's a pretty simple case for Marshall for me. Like, I don't think you really need to dive into the specifics with him to see that there's something good going on there. It's like, he's probably not as good as Chase or Justin Jefferson because they both seem insanely good. And yet, what does that mean about Marshall then if he produced pretty much on their level in the same team? Like, it's possible that those two are great and Marshall is not good, but there's not really much objective reason to suspect that. The objective indicators are that Marshall is very good because he both was explosive and basically above team baseline before this year, and then this year he took on a huge volume burden and a much worse offense, and yet his per target numbers really didn't fall off at all, even though the LSU offense fell off pretty violently aside from that. So basically with Marshall, you know, 6'3", 200, he's still very young. He'll probably test well because he was a five-star recruit. I think he might be what people wanted Denzel Mims to be, as far as like the 6'3 sideline burner type who can make big plays on the sideline and downfield. Like, I think Marshall's a more blue chip version of that premise.
Yeah, no, I like that call a lot. Yeah, because there was a lot of Mims optimism, and I always felt like it was like well-intentioned but ill-founded, and I think Marshall could be the actual expression of that hope of, you know, someone that can be that big down the sideline type of guy. And yeah, the production from, especially from the age, awesome. I knew that he was a five-star recruit. He was a bigger recruit than his teammate Jamar Chase was. Was unbelievable as far as the touchdown production goes. So, I mean, yeah, I got no quibbles with going Terrace Marshall there. I think that he'll be – it doesn't seem like he's a popular first-round mock guy, but I think that, you know, he'll be one of those guys that people go like, doh, if like two or three other receivers are taken ahead of him, you know, that they will regret that type of deal.
Yeah, I agree. But yeah, John, you're up at the seventh pick.
All right,
the receivers are depleted a bit. Where are you going?
We'll go some chalk here. This is a pretty cool dude, someone that haven't really seen the likes of him too much. Kyle Pitts out of Florida. So the first tight end off the board. He really caught my eye when he was a sophomore. I think it was that game against Miami to open the season a couple of years back, and it's like, this guy seems like too tall to be a receiver, but like too fast to be a tight end. I'm not really sure what's going on. Brevin Jordan was playing in that game too, actually. And then Pitts was destroying my Georgia Bulldogs later on in that October. And I'm like, this guy is like officially like really, really different. And then, you know, this year comes about, we're able to see what a fully fledged Dan Mullen system looks like that has a fifth-year senior at quarterback. So that, I mean, everything was set up perfectly for Pitts to have this kind of year, but like everything was also drawn up in a way to maximize him, and he answered the bell at every turn. Like he was just so insanely productive on a per target basis, especially by position. Just kind of like a cheat code. You watch the Ole Miss game from him at the start of this season, and you're just like blown away by his ability to either go up and get the ball over you, or just you know, if you get it to him down the seam, he can run away from a defense. He has that level of speed, and you know, a 6'6", 240-pound frame. It's just different. So, I mean, you're not going to expect him to play the traditional tight end role in the NFL. So there is understandably some question about what his exact role looks like. Whether he's like a Marcus Colston or something with like a souped up Marcus Colston, maybe that's the right comp. I'm not totally sure. But whatever it is, I believe in Kyle Pitts. He's super young. He's going to be special. I don't think that he's one of these tight end projects, freak athlete guys. I don't know, maybe like it's different aesthetically, like Evan Engram, workout warrior, but like not great at football. I think that like Kyle Pitts like is legitimately great at football and a freak athlete on top of it. So I love Kyle Pitts.
Yeah, so Pitts is really interesting. He only was more or less at the team baseline the last 2 years as a pass catcher, but A, he was slightly above it, and B, the age adjustment gives him a total green light because he was at or slightly above that Florida baseline in a leading volume contribution, moreover, and all the guys he was competing against were 3 to 4 years older than him. So Kyle Pitts just turned 20 in the fall. Van Jefferson's going to be 25 this summer. Freddie Swain's going to be 23 this summer. Kadarius Toney's going to be 23 this fall. And so I guess 2.5, 3 years. Trevon Grimes, I think, is 23 right now. So those guys are all 2 to 3 years or more older than him, and they still didn't outproduce him. And, you know, we still got to get the workout numbers on Pitts, but as long as his athletic testing is average or better for his size, I think the production gives a glimpse of a skill set that is pretty clearly headed toward NFL stardom. And I normally hate tight ends and as dynasty picks. Like, I was very much anti Noah Fant, and I kind of still am. Kyle Pitts is a totally different case. You're going to see people struggle to distinguish him coherently from guys like Fant, but it's a totally different game with Pitts. So I like that pick there. John, at 8, I'm going to take Justin Fields, and I'm generally a little critical of Justin Fields compared to certainly his super fans, but I think the basic deal with him is he's probably going to be a slightly faster and stronger armed version of Marcus Mariota, who I like, but who I think had pretty clear limitations in hindsight, which specifically is about his inability to kind of anticipate openings in a defense. Like Marcus Mariota was a totally flawless, just insane volume producer at Oregon because Chip Kelly kind of made it simple for him. It was sort of like a flow chart offense. It's like you get the snap, you do the read on the, you know, the run pass option. It's like you have a simple yes, no process. If it's no, you go to the next read. If it's no, you go to the next thing after that. But what there wasn't with Mariota was like the Deshaun Watson kind of just ability to see the future, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that Fields lacks that ability because you see him make amazing throws, like accuracy, arm strength, athleticism, like Mariota. It's all blue chip. Like he's going to be really good as far as that goes, which is enough for me to buy in fantasy because he's going to run quite a bit and very well. And that rushing production loophole is going to make him a good fantasy quarterback, even if he's not a good real life quarterback. But if he is a good real life quarterback, it's because he had a coach an offensive coordinator who, I guess like the best case scenario would have been Brian Daboll, but obviously he's staying in Buffalo. But if Justin Fields were in a Brian Daboll offense, I would say 100% he's going off. Like the Brian Daboll offense gives Josh Allen that kind of like flow chart system. So where his judgment doesn't come into play really all that much unless a play breaks. And you see Justin Fields a lot of the times at Ohio State, like he looks like people have said, he looks at his first read and then he doesn't know what to do if it's not there. It's like, it's not even quite that to me. I feel like he's going through his reads well enough. It's just that he needs a guy to be obviously open before he'll know to pull the trigger. And you're not going to have nearly as many obvious openings in the NFL. And with Mariota, that resulted in him kind of like holding onto the ball, taking a bunch of hits, making throws that just weren't as good as you would expect for a guy as accurate as him and with the arm strength that he had and the way he produced at Oregon. So I see some of those same risks. It's just that I'm willing to buy in because I am a Mariota truther in the sense that, like, I think he just needed a certain kind of offense, and I think it could have gone better than it did. Like, if Mariota ever ended up with Chip Kelly, I think we're living in a totally different timeline right now, basically.
I like that comp. I think that the similar concerns, and I think people want to almost like forget how good Mariota was at Oregon and coming out of college.
He was flawless.
Yes, man. Like he was crazy good. The Fields, if he ends in the right place, and you know, you just kind of alluded to, the landing in the right spot. Here's a little extra connection. You know, like he could be in play at four. It seems like the consensus has Zach Wilson going to the Jets, at least right now. So maybe Fields at four to the Falcons, Arthur Smith.
That would be great. I mean, Atlanta should try to trade up to two.
He's a local guy, too. I mean, he's from Kennesaw.
Yeah. So I actually think Fields will go ahead of Wilson, but the quarterback subject is a big one. We could talk about that for a long time. But yeah, my basic deal with Zach Wilson is I think he's going to measure with the same frame as Derek Carr. And I think some of the more meat-headed old guard coaches are going to be like, oh, I thought he would be 6'3", 225. And he's going to be more like 6'2", 215 or something, which I think will spook some people away. But in any case, yeah, with Fields, I think it's just, you know, he's going to run like a 4.38 or something like that. And he's going to look great in the pro day setting. I think he goes second among quarterbacks. And I think that's the way it should be.
Okay. I mean, just like in high school, Lawrence 1, Fields 2. I'm up next. I'll dip back into the running back. Well, I'll go Najee Harris. Blue chip pedigree, interesting frame. I think he could be at worst like a Leonard Fournette or something.
Very good pass catcher.
Yeah, he is. I mean, 27 catches on 36 targets a year ago for 304 and 7 touchdowns, caught 43 passes this past year on 57 targets, had 4 touchdowns as well. Yeah, it's just like he has a great feel for the game. He has good vision, really, you know, sturdy frame, again, like a 230-pound guy. I wonder if he'll cut a little bit of weight to run a little bit faster at the Alabama Pro Day. I wouldn't mind that necessarily. He doesn't look like the fastest guy in the world sometimes. He's not going to have to be necessarily, but wouldn't hurt either if he was more like 225, I guess, but nitpicking. But I do just feel like he's the next guy up from this group as far as running backs are concerned. This is, what, only the second running back off the board for us through 10 or through 9 picks. So
a lot of people actually have Harris as their top overall dynasty prospect this year. And, you know, a lot of people, more people yet, have him as at least their number one running back over ETN. So I think we're definitely lower on him than most. But yeah, I don't mean to sound like a critic exactly. I think it's just that people are looking at, you know, big Alabama running back projected first round, really good numbers. Maybe that's another Derrick Henry, and you got to let that kind of stuff go. Like, he isn't that. His best case outcome, in my opinion, was Le'Veon Bell, and that one I am kind of walking back a bit because he measured in at 6'2", 235. Le'Veon Bell was 6'1", 235, and I know that seems like a petty distinction to care about, but I'm sorry, I do, because I think that getting over 6'1.5 at running back is just not good unless you can push for something like 250 like Derrick Henry does. It's like, by being 250 pounds, Derrick Henry still establishes a strong anchor sort of physics with his body. But if you're 6'2", 235, it's like you're a big person, of course. Like, obviously Harris is a real hoss, but you don't want to be that narrowly built. You know, you want to be lower to the ground and wider so that when people come flying at you and hit you, they just kind of slide over you like water off of a duck. You know, you don't want to take a direct hit. And I do worry about Harris taking direct hits. I think his objective athletic comparison and like the closest comparison to him in terms of kind of production and skill set and athleticism is actually Ryan Nall. But I think it's just like, that's not me saying that I think Harris is bad. I just think like that's the closest thing to it. And he's going to be something a little bit different yet, probably because he's faster than Nall and quicker than Nall and can jump higher than Nall. And maybe that distinction is enough to make Harris a successful NFL starting running back. Like he's kind of establishing the first precedent for someone like himself. So it could go any way, really. I really don't mean any sort of insult when I compare him to Nall. It's like, if anything, I'm kind of being like a Nall truther that like, if he was just a little bit faster, he could have been good, you know? And Harris, I think, will kind of be the case study.
There was that. That was the payoff. That was the payoff for the podcast. It's the Najee Nall. Yes,
the way he should be used in the NFL is basically like Alvin Kamara. Like he's a totally different aesthetic, you know, obviously, but he's so good as a pass catcher, and getting him more work as a pass catcher would be a way to mitigate whatever frame liability that he has, because you're not taking as many direct hits in the middle of the field. And I think that could be a way to both make him productive and give him better longevity.
There we go. All right, what you got next?
10th pick, I'm going to go with – I think there's a pretty big gap between Najee Harris and Kylan Hill, but Kylan Hill is my next running back on the board. I'm going to take him. Talked about him in previous podcasts. I think he's basically, pending workout numbers, I think he's maybe something like Miles Sanders, like not a star talent, but someone who is capable of pretty explosive, small sample explosiveness with a good overall longer sample and, some upside. Like there's some explosiveness there, some pass catching upside. So if he lands in a good spot, he could be as good or better than Harris, even if Harris is the better real life player.
Okay. Yeah. I do like Kylan Hill a fair bit. Yeah. He showed that he could catch the ball this year in a very limited sample. I think that was like the one kind of question left for him. Didn't really hear a ton about him at the Senior Bowl, but I'm not going to, overweigh what that's worth.
Who cares?
Yeah, exactly. Kylan Hill was a beast of a runner in the 2019 season. Ton of volume, good production, behind a Miss State offensive line. That was good, not bereft of talent, but still, running up against SEC West defenses, it's hard to have like gaudy per carry numbers, but he was still very solid. So I do like Kylan Hill there. For me next, I'm going to go back to the receiver well. I think that this is kind of an interesting inflection point, because I think a lot of people, well, I guess Terrace Marshall really was, but who do you have rounding out the top five for you? Ooh, this is tough. I will go Rashad Bateman. Nice. Bateman. I love the physicality. I love the size. I love the instant production that he provided during his time at Minnesota. I don't think that he had great quarterback play there necessarily, or great system to kind of like prop up his numbers. Playing opposite Tyler Johnson, that was a totally explosive Minnesota offense in 2019. Bateman was good this past year as well. Obviously, Big Ten had like a very short season, everything like that. But the production, the efficiency wasn't as good as it was as a sophomore in 2019. But I think that there were some mitigating factors there. So I'm not going to hold that too far against him. And it was only a 5-game sample as well, and he was still doing over double digit targets per game. Minnesota ran the crap out of the ball this year with Mo Ibrahim, so that seemed to be a little bit more of the direction that offense wanted to go anyway. Bottom line, 6'2", 210, that's a guy you get on the outside. I think he has a little bit more athleticism than maybe you would think a Minnesota receiver would have. So, yeah, I like Bateman. It's really tough. Like this next tier of receivers, I like them all. I'm sure that I'll get sniped on one or two of these here in a minute. But if I had to just kind of like close my eyes and picture of that group one guy really, really breaking out, I think it would be Bateman. So I that was the tiebreaker for me.
Yeah, some people are very high on Bateman, and it's all for good reasons. I mean, he, production-wise, he couldn't really have done much more. We're just waiting to see what kind of an athlete he is specifically. It's like, we know he's better than Tyler Johnson, but Tyler Johnson was penalized quite a bit for that. So that's the only reason I really put a guy like Marshall ahead of him, is just because it's like, you know, the league is generally nicer to the big school guys than they are the smaller school ones. But Bateman could not have done more in the meantime to help his case. He was dominant, like you said. You taking Bateman is giving me a little bit more anxiety about the receiver supply. So I was thinking running back, but now I'm going to go with a receiver pivot. And this is based slightly on recent events. I'm going with Dyami Brown from North Carolina. And this is interesting. He was listed at 6'1", 185, and his frame was something I always noticed immediately when looking at his tape, is that I noticed that's a guy who looks different than most receivers, and being 6'1", 185 is not unique. So, you know, I was like, what the hell is unique about him then? Why does he look so different? And I think it was basically like he's just got long limbs that could use some filling out, especially if he's going to be going over the middle at all in the NFL. And what do you know? The other day I saw Fusuvu found this, I guess it was probably Instagram or something, post by Dyami Brown showing himself on a scale. And it was, I can't remember specifically, it was like 195 or 197 or something, mm-hmm. which is, you know, 10 to 12 pounds heavier than the 185 that he was listed at North Carolina. And there's a couple things that means. One is that, like, we know he could have added more weight. Like, he's already done it. He the question of whether he can bulk up is not a question anymore. And we also know that means there's less pressure on his workout numbers now, because at 6'1", 185, you're going to need to run something like a 4.4 flat or better. Whereas at 6'1", 197, if Dyami Brown runs a 4.44 or a 4.45, that still works, because the extra weight is capital too, you know? So there is a risk that he lost some of the speed by adding that weight, but we're going to find out still either way at the combo, or, you know, his pro day setting, whatever. And it basically just means, like, he doesn't need to specifically be as fast as Will Fuller to be successful in the NFL, which is generally how fast you need to be good at 6'1", 185 as a starter. But there's a lot wider range of athleticism that's acceptable for a 6'1", 195 or 197 receiver. And his production was great otherwise. So I think there's a reason to move Dyami Brown up a little from my prior rankings.
Yeah. I like that call. Yeah. I've been kind of thinking about him as a fringe top five receiver for this class. I guess he is what, our fifth receiver off the board in this little exercise. So I like that. All right, now we're moving on to the second round. We'll run through these a little bit quicker. Yeah. I'll lead things off. I guess the receiver inflation kind of pushed some of these running backs into value territory. I'll lead off round two with Kenneth Gainwell out of Memphis. Like him a lot. I just wrote Kenneth Memphis into my little spreadsheet.
That's his name for now on.
Yep, that's Memphis. It. Crazy production in his one real year to be the guy at Memphis. Didn't play this past year. Maybe that gets held against him. Maybe it doesn't. But I'm hoping that it doesn't. Hopefully he still ends up being a day two pick. I think his testing will confirm that he's a day two guy. Elite pass catching numbers, kind of just unprecedented stuff as far as his pass catching work was concerned that year, and a really strong rusher as well. Kept Antonio Gibson out at receiver because he was so good at running. So I think there's so much to like about Kenneth Gainwell's game, and I'm kind of like ready for him to like re-enter the fold of the discourse and get yes. a little bit buzzier. It feels like it's too quiet on the Kenneth Gainwell front.
They're forgetting about him. They shouldn't do that.
Fools.
So yeah, that's a good pick. You got Jamar Chase, Kenneth Gainwell on your one team there. My Travis Etienne team probably could use a, you know, receiver pick here, but in a real league, we're probably going in the third round. And in that scenario, I'm probably going to try to lean on this receiver depth in the third round rather than take someone here, as much as there's too many good options and I don't know how to pick them. Whereas when I look at running back, I'm like, Chuba Hubbard's the last one for a while for me. So I'm going to take Chuba Hubbard, even though I took ETN in the first round with this team. The basic issue is it's like, I think Hubbard's going to be a 5'11 or 6 foot, something like 208 to 215. And I think there's reason to expect a 4.4, 5.40 or better. And granted, I think he could be a little sharper with a skill set and stuff. Like he doesn't have great balance. I'm not really convinced that he's like a great anchor runner or anything. But if you're 6'2", 215 and you run a 4.4 or a 4.45 and you've got a 2,000-yard season to your name as a third-year player in the Big 12, that's one of those things where I'm inclined to be generous. You know, it's like guys as fast and productive as him don't happen that much. If he fails, I feel like it was still worth the shot. So I'm going to take Chuba Hubbard here and hope that his, you know, big play speed translates to the NFL.
Okay. Yeah, I like that. At his best, he really was a total stud. I think this year just didn't go as well as anyone would have expected or hoped, but
I think he's Ryan Matthews or something like that.
I like that comp a lot. And Ryan Matthews had a solid, productive career there for a little while. So I like that.
Just got hurt a lot. Good player, though.
Let's go. This is a tough one. Maybe I'm getting too excited by Instagram workout stuff, too. But I'll go Rondale Moore. Sometimes I just need to be reminded that, in my mind, when I think of Rondale Moore, I think crazy athlete, workout warrior type of guy. That's true. But when you physically see him jump and do a 42-inch vertical leap, it's like, okay, I need to reevaluate what exactly I'm thinking when I think of Rondale. That's something else. Just a crazy productive player from the jump at Purdue. Took on an insane volume as a true freshman. I think it's fair to knock the lack of production / the injuries over the injuries that knocked him out in 2019 basically washed his whole season, and this year wasn't exactly great either. So I do have some concerns about the durability. Is he too strong and explosive for his own good to where he's just gonna constantly have these
the Doug Martin problem?
Mm-hmm. So that I hope that he doesn't, but I just think I'll bet on the upside with him. I can totally understand poking holes in the production profile, and it's not like he was the craziest per target receiver either. He just had a ton of volume. So don't let your college football DFS brain. This is me reminding myself, kind of override what's actually going on as far as the production is concerned. For me, I think Rondale has more upside than some of these other receivers in this range, so I'll just swing for the fences a little bit and go that way.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. I mean, I wish he was in a weaker wide receiver class, because I list him at wide receiver 9 or whatever, and I could understand someone looking at that and thinking he hates Rondale Moore. And it's no, I think he's really good, and it makes me anxious to rank him this low. I hate doing it. But there's some people have him ranked as a top 3 overall pick in this class, not overall in the NFL draft, but top 3 overall dynasty prospect. And I don't really have much to argue with those people. They make good cases for it. It's just, there's a ton of talent, and talent is, 5'10" or higher in most cases, which is the only real thing that I distinguish him on. Some of those guys can clearly start, whereas more, it's we need a little bit of an outlier outcome, but it still looks like he's going to be one. So, it's hard to criticize him even much earlier than this 15th pick here. So for the 16th pick, my previous team took Jalen Waddle in the first. I'd like to get a little more balance with my roster, but I think the value is still at receiver. So I'm going to go with Amon-Ra St. Brown here to pair him with my Waddle first round pick.
Okay. Out of USC. Excellent. Indeed. So this team, fifth pick, already started things off with Devontae Smith. Couple ways I could go from here. I think just get more powerful at receiver. I will go with Amari Rodgers, and I gotta say, nice. I gotta credit you for kind of turning me back onto him as an actual prospect. I just kind of, I don't know why I was so low on him coming into this year. I felt like he was a slot only guy, and that might still be the case. But I mean, he is that densely built guy that you'd once he has the ball in his hands, most defensive backs aren't going to really want a piece of that. Like, he's a beast with the ball in his hands, built like a running back, you know, like short, but well over 200 pounds, I think like 210 pounds.
5'9", 210 is chunky.
Yeah, indeed. And, you know, had an ACL going into his junior year that spring, was able to be on the field by like week two or something. So like just unbelievable that he was able to get back from that and then be as productive as he was those last couple of seasons. So even though it took a little bit longer to break out, he was competing with some really elite dudes at Clemson, of course, for targets. So I'll forgive him for that. And I'll go Amari Rodgers there.
Nice. Yeah, that's a really good pick. I would have took him if you hadn't. Now at this point, I think I'm with my team that took Terrace Marshall, sixth overall in the first round. I'm going to go to running back, try to get some balance, and I'm going to go with Jamar Jefferson here. He's a guy who could go up or down in my rankings pending his combine workouts, and there's a few ways that could go, and I can't tell one from the other right now. So in the meantime, I'm just going to lean on the fact that Jamar Jefferson is going to be a 220-poundish sort of running back at 5'10". Really good workhorse frame, took on big workloads, including from his true freshman year at Oregon State, and he was super productive the whole time. So it's not much to say that this guy is – it's not worth that much to say that this guy is definitely better than Ryan Nall and Artavis Pierce. But, you know, it's like he definitely is better and by several additional magnitudes. So I'm pretty hopeful that he's no worse than like a fourth-round pick, and I think he could make his way up into the second if he tests okay.
Okay, that'd be interesting. If he gets into the second, that would be awesome. He's very talented player, so I'm with you there. Really intriguing profile with him. Just doesn't get enough pub because he played for Oregon State, but no, I like that pick a lot. I think that, yeah, we've reached a point where running backs are back in that value or in that value category, and the receivers maybe not quite as much of steals right now. So I will tail you on that one, and I will go with Javonte Williams out of North Carolina. He had a crazy year. I don't think there's really any way around saying that. And I think that like the frame looks good. I wonder how athletic he is exactly. But yeah, 5'11", 220, I'll take it. Not much else to say on that one.
Yep. I was choosing between Williams and Jefferson at the previous pick, and they're largely the same guy to me. Like they're both in rounds 2 to 4 for me, pending the workout numbers, and they're both 220-pound guys. So they're both interesting for their workhorse upside, and it'll probably just be the combine that breaks their workout numbers that breaks the tie for me. A lot of people are really high on Williams. A lot of people have him in like their top five. So we are probably a little bit lower than them, but I agree that we're pretty optimistic for him. With that said, so with this pick, I'm getting my second pick for my Justin Fields team, I believe it is.
Yep.
And so I could use a running back or receiver, but the running backs are pretty well drained at this point. I think I'm looking at receiver or quarterback. I'm looking at receiver as I took Fields in the first one. I think it's got to be Tylan Wallace that I go with here. He's a guy who he's only listed like 6 foot 190 or something, and he's got a couple knee injuries in the past couple of years that might be of some level of concern. But as long as he tests at an average level athletically, I think you have to project him as a viable starter in the NFL because he put up big efficiency and big volume numbers as a receiver at Oklahoma State in a way that was better than someone like James Washington, who's kind of been middling as a third round pick. I don't think you could call him a bust exactly, but he hasn't been great either. But Wallace is clearly better than him, in my opinion, and clearly better certainly than someone like Marcel Aitman or whoever else. So I think Wallace is the best Oklahoma State receiver since Dez probably, and I like getting him this late. I think he would be like a first round pick in a weaker class, which is, you know, this receiver class is just insanely good.
Yes, it definitely is. So I like that Tylan Wallace pick. I think that kind of ended up being a nice little steal there.
Yeah.
For the ninth pick in the second round, so this team took Najee in the first.
It's getting tough now.
It really is. I will go with Zach Wilson.
Nice.
The quarterback out of BYU. DFS legend this year. Just a fun player to watch. I think he's got that arm talent that you know people are looking for. I understand you know what you were saying earlier about you know maybe he checks in with less than that you know ideal frame and maybe that pushes him back. But I still think he's starting in the NFL right away, and I think that he can be good. He had stuff to him like after his freshman year that I thought was encouraging. Wasn't great in 2019, but was fine. And then I think really kind of settled in and found another level. I wonder if he will have a similar kind of like learning curve in the NFL where it takes him a couple years for things to click. But he's got some things that can kind of smooth over whatever deficiencies that he does have. So I will go with Wilson. I think that he should end up being you know pretty close to a stud on Sundays.
Yeah, it looks like he can run a bit too.
Yes.
So that's always helpful. Raises the floor for fantasy. I'm making a weird pick, or at least I think it would be a little bit controversial to a lot of people. With the 22nd pick overall, my Kylan Hill team with the 10th pick, I'm going to take Anthony Schwartz, who most people are pretty low on, and I even understand why.
Schwartz.
Sorry.
No.
But he's one of those guys who I just feel like when you look at his objective speed, which is to say he's probably like a 4.25, like that's the low range for him is something like a 4. If he ran slower than Henry Ruggs, it would be an upset basically. And so he might break John Ross's 4.22 with a 4.21 or even a 4.2 flat. And as much as I think he has like kind of an incomplete skill set, when you have speed like that, you only need a little bit of skill to be viable for an NFL rep. And it's like we're trying to get guys who get snaps and get targets. And I think that speed is going to get Schwartz on the field even before his skill set is fully developed. And I think his skill set might be a little bit underrated because he was above the Auburn baseline this year. Granted, he's not doing like the high difficulty downfield targets that Seth Williams was. But he was productive, you know, and he's only 20 this last fall. He's only going to be 21 this fall. Considering he might have been a little bit stunted in his development by being such a track emphasis guy, and since he's abandoned track and now is only focusing on football, I think he, you know, at the very worst is looking at something like, I don't know, Marquise Goodwin kind of career. And I think that in the meantime, he's probably underrated for his skill and therefore like his upside, considering the speed we're talking here. So I'll go with Schwartz to pair him with Kylan Hill.
Okay. And then my last pick here for this exercise, the 11th pick of the second round. This team started things off with Rashad Bateman, is going to end up double tapping at receiver. I'm going to go Elijah Moore.
Nice.
I loved how automatic he was the last couple of years. And I mean, he got 50 targets as a freshman at Ole Miss. You know, that's a 2018. That's a team that had AJ Brown and DK Metcalf on it. And he still got 50 targets. That's pretty good. 36 of those 50 targets. Really, you know, became automatic this year once Lane Kiffin installed his offense at Ole Miss. You know, had some talented guys around him, but Moore was just clearly just so far ahead of the pack. As far as those Ole Miss receivers were concerned, the production per, you know, opportunity, over 10 yards a target on over 100 targets, that's nuts. So I know he's a smaller guy, but he's a guy I don't want to bet against, and I think that he might end up being better than like just what he might be greater than the sum of his parts, basically, and so I'll go with him.
Yeah, he was insanely productive, and I mentioned this in the wide receiver rankings from a month ago, but if I could be guaranteed he'd go in like the first two rounds, I would move him way up, because the only concern with him is whether he gets on the field, and he's like a slot receiver build. So if the further he falls, the more you have to worry about him only playing in three wide sets. But if a team takes him in the second round, it pretty much or higher, it means that they are going to give him starter snaps. And if he's getting starter snaps, there's not really any doubt at that point for me, because his production was definitely infallible at Mississippi. So a lot of upside with Moore. I would not fault anyone for taking him even earlier than you did there, and definitely like him as a 23rd overall pick. John, for 24, the final pick here, my team in the first round took Dyami Brown, 12th overall. I'm going to do a bit of a reach here, chasing some upside at a position that will become scarce quickly in this draft. Ramondre Stevenson at running back. And I know that the floor is pretty low. We don't really know what he is. But one thing we do know that he is a huge guy who can take a lot of workload. And he caught passes really well at Oklahoma. Looks pretty freaking fast for how big he is, too. So if this is a guy who was very productive as a runner and a pass catcher at Oklahoma and therefore has like unique workhorse upside, unique three down upside in this class, which after him basically just has the only cool guys after that are like 5'9", 185, 190. You know, the Javian Hawkins is the Jarrett Pattersons. So Stevenson is the last chance at a workhorse. I'll take him here and hope that his drug test or whatever is a thing of the past very soon.
Yes, yes. So, yeah, Stevenson, very, very intriguing. And I think you have it framed right where, like, you know, some of these other guys are really fun, perhaps even more fun than Ramondre Stevenson. I think Michael Carter kind of fits that bill. But, like, they're not going to push for 250 carries in their best range of outcomes the way that Stevenson possibly could.
Yeah, there's upside, and it's the late second. Why not take a risk?
Amen. Okay. All right. Well, that's going to round it out. For this week's edition of the RotoWire NFL podcast, we, of course, will be back next week breaking down some news and notes from around the league, and we'll come up with something good for next week as well. So stay tuned for more, and thanks for listening.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft, but Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink, which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.